following is a lecture given by His Holiness Ravindrasrupabhu from the Srimad Bhagavatam, Canto 3, Chapter 23, Text 44, on May 3rd, 2001 in Philadelphia.
Just the conclusion now of the honeymoon journey of Devabhuti and Kardamamuni through the universe. Text 44. Vibhajya,
Vibhajya,
Navadha,
Navadha,
Atmanam,
Atmanam,
Manavim,
Manavim,
Surato Sukham,
Surato Sukham,
Ramam,
Ramam,
Niramayan,
Niramayan,
Reme,
Reme,
Varshapugan,
Varshapugan,
Muhurtavat, Vibhajya Navadatmanam
Vibhajya Navadatmanam
Manavim Suratau Sukham
Manavim Suratau Sukham
Rama Niramayan Rene
Rama Niramayan Rene
Varshapugan Muhurtavat
Varshapugan Muhurtavat
Vibhajya
Vibhajya
Having divided. Navadha into nine. Atmanam. Himself. Manavim. The daughter of Manu. Devahuti. Surata. For sex life. Utsukam. Who was eager. Raman, to his wife, Niramayan, giving pleasure,
Reme,
he enjoyed, Varshapugan, for many years, Muhurtavat, like a moment. Translation. After coming back to his hermitage, he divided himself into nine personalities, just to give pleasure to Devabhuti, the daughter of Manu, who was eager for sex. In that way, he enjoyed with her for many, many years, which passed just like a moment. Srila Prabhupada's purport. Here, the daughter of Swayambhuva Manu, Devabhuti, is described as Suratotsuka, that is to say, eager for sexual enjoyment. After traveling with her husband all over the universe, Mount Meru and the beautiful gardens of the heavenly kingdoms, she naturally became sexually stimulated. And in order to satisfy her sexual desire, Kardamamuni expanded himself into nine forms. Instead of one, he became nine. And nine persons had sexual intercourse with Devahuti for many, many years. It is understood that the sexual appetite of a woman is nine times greater than that of a man. That is clearly indicated here. Otherwise, Kardamamuni would have had no reason to expand himself into nine. Here is another example of yogic power. As the Supreme Personality of Godhead can expand himself into millions of forms, a yogi can also expand up to nine forms, but not more than that. Another example is that of Sobarik Muni. He also expanded himself into eight forms. But however powerful a yogi may be, he cannot expand himself into more than eight or nine forms. The Supreme Personality of Godhead, however, can expand himself into millions of forms, ananta rupa, innumerable, countless forms, as stated in the Brahma Samhita. No one can compare to the Supreme Personality of Godhead by any conceivable energetic manifestation of power. Vibhajya navadatmanam manavim suratotsukam rama
Niramayan Remei Varashipu Gan Mahutabad. Coming back to his hermitage, he divided himself into 9 personalities just to give pleasure to Devahuti, the daughter of Manu, who was eager for sex life. In that way, he enjoyed with her for many, many years, which passed just like a moment. So here's a point that's become controversial, I think. It is understood that the sexual appetite of a woman is 9 times greater than that of a man. There's some texts, I think, from Chanakya, Pandit, which states like that. I don't remember it exactly, but it and Prabhupada repeats this in different places like that. And so I've run across a number of devotees now, especially women, who regard this as a sexist statement and are ready to dismiss it. One woman, a leader of Germany, told me that just blew it off. She said, well, I mean, how can you say that women are more sex desire than men? Men are the ones that rape. He said, I didn't say anything, but at that time I didn't feel like getting into a discussion with this woman about so I've heard this now a number of times, this kind of a statement that a Prabhupada, sometimes in other places he's being misquoted, but here this is as you can see right clearly, he states here that understood that sexual appetite of a woman is 9 times greater than that of a man. And So there's a number of people, I think, maybe even a growing number of people, who now I want to say that these statements are sexist statements. They think that either Prabhupada was maybe sexist or at least old-fashioned, and have these obsolete ideas disproven by they're not currently fashionable ideas, let's put it that way. Or that Prabhupada was just repeating statements of older authorities faithfully, and they were sexist, even though Prabhupada wasn't. That's another one. What this means, however, if you want to say that this is going on, is I think the implication has to be that Prabhupada was a conditioned soul. That the hero statements in the tradition of Prabhupada are false. They're clearly false statements. Everybody knows. Men are more or less dealing with it, I guess. Or something like that. Anyway, it's clearly a false statement. Prabhupada's making this false statement. And so we have to deal with that. And there are false statements in the Vedas. Lots of them, actually. There's this kind of stuff about men and women. And there's all the astronomy, all those kinds of things, clearly false, and so forth. So we need to go through now and sort of pick and choose what's true and what's false. Of course, this means that Prabhupada, of course, this isn't what Prabhupada tells us how to accept the Vedas. He says the Vedas come to us, they're not a product of conditioned souls. He says conditioned souls have 4 defects. But the Vedas are not like that. Therefore, they can be accepted. They should be accepted without any change. So people are uncomfortable with that too. It sounds a little fundamentalistic. And do you really, are they really accepted anyway without change? I mean, the prophet says that, but look, you know, you go through our tradition, you see it changes a lot. Anyway, this is what really goes on, even though people say they're not changed. Some of this is from devotees who have had some exposure now to academics. And they find out that these statements that Prabhupada makes, that the Vedas are not produced by conditioned souls. Of course they're produced by conditioned souls. Of course. Everybody knows that. Because this is actually the premise. This is not the conclusion, by the way. It's the premise of academic studies. Academic studies of religion is it's basically an enlightenment enterprise. And its pioneering breakthrough was you start with the Bible, for example, supposedly revealed, and text, every word is sacred. The first five books of the Old Testament were all written by Moses himself, and they come down from God, and similarly in the New Testament you have a statement of, you know, the direct disciples of Jesus who were also telling us the big authorities and what Jesus is about, what Christianity is about. You have to be accepted on top of authority. But then starting around starting in the early 19th century, maybe late 18th century, people's another way of looking at things, and you got what you call critical scholarship. And the assumption was that these texts are not handed down for being complete, but rather they may contain some inspiration in them, but basically that inspiration has been filtered through the ideas and preconceptions of socially and historically conditioned beings. And therefore, a great deal of it is to be rejected. The Bible wasn't, the five books of Moses were not written by Moses. By textual analysis, you can prove that actually there were three biblical accounts, two put together from different sources by a third person, the editor, and so on. And they go on and on. And Christians, liberal Christians anyway, are having a hard time now, especially with the Gospel of John, since it seems to be a source of anti-Semitism. Jews have very bad press in the fourth Gospel. And of course St. Peter was another misogynist, and anyway, on and on you go with this kind of stuff. And you know, they're also against gays and all, you know. So they're not up to date, and we have to simply continuously revise these documents to keep them current with the times. This is the way people have done with their. I had one professor, Paul Van Buren, who is famous as one of the Death of God theologians, and he wrote a book called The Secular Meaning of the Gospels. We know that people don't walk on water. We know that people don't come back from the dead or raised from the dead. We know that, you know, that the, you know, that basically something happened with Jesus, who was apparently some kind of real inspiring teacher, and these early days people put a lot of mythology onto him, all these fictions. So we get rid of the fictions, and basically we have certain socially uplifting, politically liberal messages that happen to coincide with our beliefs anyway, that secular meaning of the gospel. And you know, there was this Bultmann, the demythologizing. But earlier on, the search for the historical Jesus, what was really going on. So people have done a thorough job so, you know, the same people that have done this with Christianity, we also would like to do this with our text. So, this what Prabhupada says, for example, in it's printed as the introduction to the Ishopanishad, that the Vedas are aparusheya, that they're not the product of the conditioned soul, and therefore we can get reliable knowledge from them. This is just rejected as fundamentalism. And if you say something like this in a university, you're made to be thought, you just regard it as an idiot. Just automatically, everybody looks at you and says, "Why do you have an opinion like that?" You know. Certainly, if you go to graduate school, either you keep your mouth shut, or you change your mind, or you lie. you get what is called a more nuanced view. So what to do? So this is happening also. It's these that have crept into our movement, especially they've crept into our movement. So this is something actually that we have to deal with. I remember very early on, I heard a lecture by Prabhupada, a tape. I don't know whether I can find it in folio or not. But I heard a tape. Prabhupada said about scripture. He says, if you can doubt one thing, then you can doubt the whole thing. Which is, I thought about that quite some time. And I believe that Prabhupada is correct when he says that. Because it means that now, if I can say, okay, here's scripture, I get a lot of inspiration from it, I accept this part, but I don't accept this part. Now I'm the judge. I suppose I go to Krishna consciousness because I'm a conditioned soul. And I want to become liberated. I'm trapped in the material world. I want to become released. Here's the instrument of my release. The bound cannot save the bound, as Prabhupada said. I'm going to like pick and choose what I accept and what I don't accept. I'm the person with the problem. But now I'm going to solve the problem that scripture has. How am I in a position to judge? I accept this, I accept that. This is true, that is true. So Prabhupada said that it is true. Once you start saying, well, this part I accept, this part I reject, you'll find out now once you become the judge, anything is up for grabs. Once you're the authority, anything, the whole thing becomes up for grabs. So what Prabhupada told us is, you know, it's all or nothing. So as I said, I heard this very early on in my career, and I decided, well, okay, it's all or nothing. What about all these things that I had trouble, like I had trouble believing in demigods, for example. Or, you know, so many things were there. So I just decided, okay, I'll accept it. And the other thing is, at least my experience is that I had been an academic, and I'd watched these people pick apart the Christian tradition, and I saw what had happened. No one's being saved. For all this liberalism, you know, all they come out with is sort of, we're going to protest the war in Vietnam and do some socially uplifting work, and that's it. No one's saved. the people who were the big proponents of this doctrine were not even happy in the material world. To me, they were a distinctly unhappy group of people. And, you know, having trashed their whole religious tradition and its traditional authority, they were now just made themselves more and more miserable. Yeah, I didn't think these people saw. I mean, but then when I looked at least at Prabhupada, I thought, well, there's a different kind of a person. And so here is a liberated soul. And I thought that Prabhupada was, I began to see that he was the most extraordinary person I'd ever met, and far, far smarter than anyone I'd ever met. And it was clear that he wasn't a stupid. I met fundamentalists too. I'd been exposed to those quite a bit in my childhood. And Prabhupada, whatever he wasn't one of those people. So it was a kind of, I have to admit, it was an act of faith. Just Prabhupada said, if you can doubt one thing, you can doubt the whole thing. So, and I guess for a long time, the ISKCON protected itself from these kind of doubts simply by being kind of isolated and insulated from the material world. But now we're becoming a little more socially integrated, I suppose. People are going to graduate school, getting mundane educations, getting exposed to all this stuff. Now they have doubts. And certainly, because of political correctness, and I just got an email letter from somebody who's really upset about Prabhupada's statement about homosexuals and so on. Because now, just right off the bat, statements, at least in the early 70s, didn't really strike a lot of people as these statements, like about women, didn't strike people right away. At least the men in the movement didn't strike them as being particularly wrong. Now it does, because, you know, another generation has come up. And now, right off the bat, you get ruled out of court as immoral, practically speaking. Anyway, so what to do with this situation? I think probably one has to defend it, even on empirical grounds. I think that, first of all, the idea that, just go back to the sexual appetite of women, 9 times greater. I don't know about the number 9. I don't know how you go about quantifying these things. As far as men are the ones that rape, that's a fact. They do. But all at the same time, there's people that point this out also say that rape is not about sex, it's about anger. So maybe that men are more angry. I don't know. But the fact that men rape doesn't necessarily mean that men are more lusty than women, more sexual desire. On the other hand, I don't know so much about the literature in this subject of sexual desire, but I have seen, and this stuff I read in the newspaper and magazines here and there, that there's a case made by feminists that women have far greater sexual capacity than men. And they're quite angry that men have been frightened of the sexual capacity of women and have engaged in a conspiracy lasting for centuries to deny women their satisfaction. I think there's a... So there's a counter case could be made because in circles in which sexual desire is a good thing, the women are celebrated for this capacity. And certainly men who resent this are just showing their envy of women. And again, that's misogynistic. But anyway, the fact is, they think that women actually have far greater ability for sexual enjoyment than men do. Now, the physiological facts upon which you would make this case, it's this. It's a well-known fact, I think, that a man will have sex, and then afterwards, for sexual purposes, for some time, he's useless. There's a recycle time that's necessary for a man to be able to have sex again. How long that is, it probably depends upon his age and other factors. Definitely, there's some downtime. Whereas a woman does not not built this way, and so it's actually possible. For example, if Kardama Muni had 9 Devahutis, it doesn't serve any purpose. He'd be no more satisfied by 9 than by 1. But if Devahuti had 9 Kardama Munis, she could keep going. I just want to point this physiological fact out. I mean, this is a... So on this basis, I think men probably do envy women this capacity for sexual enjoyment. And I suspect on this basis one can claim that these claims of the women have a great sexual capacity than men has some basis in fact. Now, I don't know how much research I have to do into this thing and read Masters and Johnsons and all these guys who have done all this research. It's not really the kind of stuff that Bhagavatam is tough enough in these areas, but I suspect the facts are really there. Similarly, there are other things. As Prabhupada has been quoted to me as saying that women like to be raped. Women enjoy being raped. I know where this text is, actually. It's in the Bhagavatam that they're referring to. That's not what Prabhupada says. It's very interesting, by the way, that Prabhupada says one thing and then is widely quoted as saying something else. And you can go to the actual passage in Bhagavatam and see what Prabhupada said. Nevertheless, people have it wrong. What Prabhupada says is that a woman enjoys a man who is expert at rape. I think that's a kind of subtle difference, not so subtle difference actually, between enjoy being raped and enjoying a man who is expert at raping. I happened to run across an article in the New York Times section many, many years ago by a woman writer, in which she in fact makes the same claim. She didn't know what Prabhupada said. Of course, this article was written in 72 or something like that. But she's a fairly well-known writer who was kind of irritated by the burgeoning feminism that was saying, what is okay for women to like and what is not okay for women to like in matters of sex. And so she pointed out that she conducted surveys among women she knew and her friends and other people like that. I don't think it was really a kind of scientific controlled survey or something like that, but random sampling. But anyway, she discovered that this article was titled something like Women's Pornography. What kind of reading material women find sexually stimulating? And it's quite different. Apparently, what men like are very literal, graphic descriptions of sex acts, basically bowels and distance kinds of stuff, those kinds of things. Crude, crass, sexually explicit, devoid of any thing like relationships or anything, just animal sex, which women apparently don't find too exciting. They find it disgusting, actually. Maybe they've changed now, but anyway, this is 72 back. What turned women on were quite different. And in fact, what turned women on got past the censors. And she cited, she was talking about movies, actually, which are not sexually explicit. But the books on which the movies based were also out there, of two sex scenes that women found to be the most arousing. This is a famous scene in the movie and book Gone with the Wind, and a famous scene in the movie and book Fountainhead. Both books written by women, Margaret Mitchell and Ayn Rand, in which they're basically rapes. I don't know, people don't read these books anymore. Maybe the Fountainhead is still read, but Gone with the Wind is gone. But in the movie, there's the hero, Rhett Butler, played by Clark Gable, and the heroine, Scarlett O'Hara, played by Vivian Leigh. And Rhett Butler is, he's I think they're married, actually. He's married to her. But he thinks she's like this very refined and pure emblem of Southern womanhood. And so he's very inhibited when it comes to sex. He used to go out faster than, but now, he's got the proper woman on the pedestal. But finally, the thing is that he finally it's a famous scene in the movie. He picks her up and carries her up to the bedroom up this big curved flight of stairs while she's pounding, no, she's pounding on his chest, protesting, no. And in the book, there's all this prose about her being basically overpowered, overwhelmed, dominated, is what she always wanted, because she was always. But this scene, actually, women admit, that was quite a thing. I remember when I was a kid in high school, some girl asked me if I ever read Gone with the Wind, and I said no. So she gave me a copy of the book, and I read it. And on the page in which this sex scene took place, and there was absolutely nothing explicit, it was all like sort of emotions, about emotions, more than about what was actually happening, which was really irritating to me. But somebody, some girl with lipstick on, had kissed those pages. There were these lipstick marks all over these pages. And I thought, why would anybody? I mean, I knew it was a sex scene, but why this lipstick? And I sort of had this picture in my mind of some fairly pubescent girl, you know, rolling around the bed kissing these pages. I couldn't understand. It wasn't until years later I read this article that I knew what was going on. This was pornography. And the other one, so I mean, Scott O'Hara was a very dominating, kind of a very powerful person in his own right. And, you know, with Rhett Butler, there was this clash of wills, and he kind of like, so finally he dominates her, and it's basically a rape, but very expert. You have to call an expert rape. Same thing happens in the Fountainhead book and movie, where Ayn Rand has these superheroes. And one is this architect. I forget their names now. Everybody reads in business school Ayn Rand. Ayn Rand. Anyway, he's this architect played by Gary Cooper in the movie. Kind of a rugged individualist. And the woman is another rugged individualist, kind of super people. And so naturally when they meet, there's sparks because each of them have like big egos, false egos, you know. So finally when they mate, you know, again it's like a rape scene. You know, the woman is into it. She's really into it. Being, you know, overwhelmed and kind of dominated by this man. So anyway, you could say that on the basis of this article, that isn't there something to talk about in Bhagavatam class? But I guess if people will deny it, so I think that what Prabhupada says in this case or in a case like that is what he means. There's a factual basis to what he says. A woman likes a man who's expert, right? Doesn't mean being knocked over in a parking lot by somebody you don't know. You know, not expert at all. Nobody likes it. Expert. Like Rhett Butler. So anyway, I have the article if anyone wants to read it. Pornography for women. I figured I would just cut it out. You know, I figured one day it would come in useful. I went back and looked for it because I could see that this stuff is going to come up again. I don't really, I mean, I see in the, you know, there's books advertised women's sexual fantasies. I don't want to read it, but I hope you don't have to carry this research too much further. to prove these things, and the point is, I think that these statements by Prabhupada, first of all, on a factual basis, are defensible. I mean, you can defend them, even though it may not be currently politically correct to do that. The only reason to do it is not to promote any particular view on these matters. I don't think ultimately they're so very important. But once you start deciding that just very casually blowing Prabhupada off as a conditioned soul or what amounts to that, you're creating for yourself big problem, and we may have to defend these things. I really think that Prabhupada is not a, everybody who knew Prabhupada, I think, knew him, knew he was a conditioned soul. There's not a woman in ISKCON who knew Prabhupada ever thought that he was anything like sexist. It just wasn't there. And so therefore, why does he make these statements that can be easily read as or interpreted or sound like sexist statements? Well, that's an interesting thing to find out. It's worth knowing why he said this. It's worth knowing what they really mean. Because they're not designed to affirm no false ego. They're not out of anxiety. What's it for? Why are they there? That's a whole other topic. But the assumption has to be that for me anyway, that Prabhupada is a liberated soul. And maybe Chanakya Pandit's not a liberated soul. I don't think we have to make that claim for him. But if Prabhupada quotes him, then he quotes him. Chanakya Pandit gathered these quotations from the Puranas. And again, the Puranas are not all pure. Bhagavatam is Amalam Purana. That means the other are not Amalam. Some are in the mode of passion, some are in the mode of ignorance. So they may reflect points of view that are not useful for those engaged in passive transcendence. Nevertheless, what Prabhupada and Acharyas in our line, Vishnu Chakravarti, they pass on to us, that we have to accept as having some valuable truth to it. So anyway, that's the controversy about nine times lusty. The reason I'm thinking about this is when I go to Radhadesh, this is what I'm supposed to talk about, not this particular issue, but the issue of understanding Srila Prabhupada. Because more and more devotees have become they have doubts now about Prabhupada, maybe starting with doubts about Harikesh or somebody, and then Harikesh blaming his problems on Prabhupada and having doubts about some of the things Prabhupada did, establish gurukulas or whatever that didn't work out, and now and maybe having doubts about certain regulative principles like no illicit sex. I'm thinking maybe that was a mistake. And so, I want to have sex, and so how far is the moon away anyway? So I don't know what exactly the connection is. I think there are some people have motives, not everybody. Some people just want to know. Some people may have ulterior motives in this matter. And so, maybe it was 5 minutes. Any questions or comments? Yeah?
I'm wondering how we understand. You said, as far as the brain size,
That's not written in his books. That's not even spoken in a lecture, I don't think. That was spoken to a reporter. He was quoting from his physiology textbook. Now, that's one of these things where you back up your position with modern science, and then later on modern science changes. What? No. Because see, just after that, you have to also understand what Prabhupada says in context. So he was in an argument with a reporter. So it was Prabhupada's characteristic not to lose arguments. And he liked to be a debater, and also he liked to he liked to what do you call it irritate and agitate reporters also. They like to goof on them. So this number of ounces he got from his some textbook, because he was that was about intelligence, woman's intelligence being less than a man. So he backed it up with the cranial capacity, the brain size, which he got from the textbook of his. But then just after that he came to Philadelphia, and it came up again. And with the reporter, she brought it up again. And again, Prabhupada defended himself. And anyway, after it was at a darshan, it was over, and I was sitting next to Prabhupada, and there were some women. They were upset, naturally. They came up to Prabhupada. Vishaka was one of them. I forgot who was there. I remember Vishaka. I think she asked the question. She says, "Is it true, Srila Prabhupada, that the women in the Hare Krishna movement are less intelligent than the men?" And Prabhupada said, "Oh no," he said, "when you become a devotee, your brain grows." That's what he said. So then I could understand that, first of all, he wasn't talking literally. You know, I mean, I don't think brain literally grows, you know, so many ounces to so many ounces, whatever it is. And he was also not making a statement about women in ISKCON. That, you know, any man is more intelligent than any woman. And that's obviously not the case. So anyway, that's what he said. So that's why I kind of don't take the whole thing as something that's a literally true thing. I don't think he took it that seriously. Yeah?
There also seems to be lust doesn't necessarily have to do with sex.
No, it doesn't. That's the other thing. It's a good point, is that the sexual desire of a woman expresses itself in a different way than a man. Now, first of all, there are subtle forms of sex desire, profit, adoration, and distinction, which are often more powerful than they're directed that way to ordinary lust. But I remember, just another foray into practical affairs, one time somebody very ill-advised in the early days of the movement decided to do Sankirtan in drive-in movie theaters. They were still drive-in movie theaters in the 70s. And they would do it late at night, and they would show sex movies. I don't guess they were like today's completely, totally X-rated stuff, but they were pretty bad. And so devotees, for a few nights, were going car to car. So these movies were playing, can you imagine? Knocking, you know, the windows all steamed up. I don't know, but they had to stop it because and there were many women doing this because the men were just falling apart. They're so agitated by all this explicit sex stuff. The women weren't particularly bothered, but the men were like just you know, in a state. The other sankirtan was going door to door. And that would really get the women very upset. Because, they come to somebody's house, and there's this little house, and there's the daddy, and there's the mommy, and there's the little kid, and there's a nice little dining room set, and all this other stuff. And they would get very agitated. It was actually agitated, you know. They would want that very, very, very badly. And the men weren't attracted to that. So I think the thing that the way it expresses itself may also be quite different. That's a good point. But anyway, so I noticed that. Anybody else have any other questions? Yeah.
Isn't there a further implication that since Krishna authored the Vedas and he created the Varnashram Dharma system, that if you think these statements are sexist, that Krishna himself is sexist in this whole system?
Well, he's the supreme male, isn't he? Yeah, I guess, well, people do have a case against God, you know. And some feminists have thought of it better to replace him with a female god. There's their Maya body underneath it. Yeah, well, Varnashram Dharma is certainly objectionable to the same people. It's hierarchical. There's this idea that hierarchy is a male idea, male invention. Oh, there's this whole, you know, fantasy anthropology. This Gambutas, she was an anthropologist at Berkeley, you know, gave this whole science fiction, really science. I mean, anthropology is speculative enough. She did even that. There was before in Europe, there was a primordial matriarchal paradise, and where there was peace and harmony and love, women were in control, worshipping a female goddess. And this was the time of peace and harmony. There was no war because women don't fight. Everybody knows that. So on. And then these nasty guys, these Indo-Europeans, invaded Europe with their war gods, their hierarchy, and so on, and destroyed it. So patriarchal, hierarchical, warrior society. This is her idea. Almost all anthropologists, it goes even too far for them, you know, because it's just, as you said, it's like science fiction, more so than usual in anthropology. So it's not there. But this is the kind of thing that people want. So anyway, they say that hierarchy is a male invention. This is wrong, of course. Even among hens, there's a pecking order. I don't think it's imposed by the rooster. These things happen. So they're against Varnashram Dharma. Once you want to go to what's politically correct, all of Varnashram Dharma is out the window completely. That's gone. The Varnas, the Ashrams. Yeah, you should see the stuff scholars do with that one.
Yeah, there's a book by a scholar which I haven't read yet, Classifying the Universe, which is a whole tack.
Varnashram Dharma is just basically a plot by the Brahmanas to keep themselves in power. Again, the work of conditioned souls, only interested in their sense gratification, achieving their own ends. What you do is you take what you see happen in recent historical times, you know, a Marxist conception of ideology and a Marxist conception of history, and then read it into everything, including the Vedas. Anything else? Anyway, I apologize for the sexually explicit nature of this. Sorry to bother people, but I guess we have to get into it. You know, I don't know how far, but you already asked something. What about you? You have something? No, you're stretching. Okay. Well, we have to stop now. We'll talk. Srila Prabhupada, the keys.